The following podcast of The Mincing Rascals may contain some pettifogging. Parents with young children should use discretion in listening to and sharing this episode. This is John Williams, and we'll start there at the Trump trial and then take a hard dive into what's happening at the Chicago Tribune as it comes under the influence of a hedge fund, then cannabis street vendors, red light cameras, cats and dogs living together, the usual mass hysteria. Please do me this favor. Tell your friends to listen to The Mincing Rascals. We really appreciate you dialing us in. We'd like more downloads. The more, the better for all of us. Trust me on that. So could you be a little ambassador for The Mincing Rascals? Have your friends give us a try. And give us a good rating, too, if you deem us worthy. And email the gang via me, johnwilliams@wgnradio.com.
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria.
Today is Thursday. It is January 23rd, 2020, at 12:43 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams. You can hear me weekdays on WGN Radio from 1 to 3. We are The Mincing Rascals, the podcast we record at the studios of WGN.
I'm Steve Bertrand, wondering why John is laughing.
Because normally I say the one part first and then the second part after, and today I mixed them up.
That is so funny.
And now we go to Justin Kaufman.
Where's the laugh track? We need a laugh track.
Justin Kaufman, WGN Radio.
Heather Sharone, The Daily Line.
Eric Zorn, the proudly pettifogging columnist from the Chicago.
Pettifogging. Chief Justice John Roberts asked the senators to no longer pettifog.
In the 1905 Swain trial, a senator objected when one of the managers used the word pettifogging, and the presiding officer said the word ought not to have been used.
That they should remember where they are and their rhetoric should accommodate the chamber.
Well, in the chamber, formerly known as the greatest deliberative body in the world.
He was quoting someone from the 19th century, right?
Yeah, but I mean...
It wasn't like his pettifog wasn't
who
his...
doesn't these days? I mean, this seems like a go-to.
But I mean, it wasn't his adjective. He was citing someone
It's just
else.
More jiggery-pokery, if you ask me.
Well, speaking of quoting people, though, in the Senate chambers, what was it? One of the late-night comics said...
He laid out a ton of evidence against the president, much of it sound bites of Trump himself, and he invoked the founding fathers and their words a lot. Schiff quoted Hamilton so many times today, he was nominated for 5 Tony Awards.
And I think Adam Schiff is doing a very even, credible, good job. I know that some people on Fox News, Sean Hannity, said he's lost his mind.
He is a lunatic. He was totally unhinged. He looked like a lunatic who's lost his mind, babbling, repeating over and over and over and over again incoherently.
I have to say, I'm paying attention to it, and I'm confused because I thought, and you kind of referenced it, Eric, this idea that there's so many rules and regulations on how you actually do this, and it seems every day someone just throws it out the window. And I wasn't sure. I thought that if the Senate was a juror, they can't leave when the trial is on. And these senators, Republican senators, are so don't want to sit through Schiff's argument that they just walk out of the room. How is that possible? I just wonder. I don't know the answer.
How true is that? I heard Lindsey Graham has left. That's absolutely true.
It is. Yeah. The New York Times has been sort of cataloging when they've left the chambers.
They should. Because
Martha McSally did a Fox interview while the trial was going on.
You should be able to see the senators to see if they're there, to see how attentive they are, to see if they're looking at their phones. They're not supposed to have them, but they're counting their smartphones as devices.
The new rules? Because if the new rules, next time I get jury duty, if I got to leave the room for whatever reason while they're in the middle of the trial, I'll just do it, right?
Well, there's no one to enforce them, right?
Yeah. Well,
right.
There is
essentially,
someone, I mean,
John Roberts would have to order the sergeant-at-arms to restrain the senator in some way.
He issued all of them the oath that said that he would do that.
Did he really?
Sure, under punishment
of imprisonment.
The sergeant-at-arms will make the proclamation.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons are commanded to keep silent on pain of imprisonment while the House of Representatives is exhibiting to the Senate of the United States articles of impeachment against Donald John Trump.
All of us who've covered trials know that they do take frequent breaks, and the judge is usually fairly deferential to the jury. He'll say, does anyone in the jury need a break? And they break actually kind of a lot if you're covering a long trial. It's right. It's really, you know, because he says we'll break for 5 minutes and like it's always 15.
So it's on Roberts. He's got to get some more breaks up.
Well, I agree with Justin. If they're going to be actually sitting in judgment of this evidence, they ought to be sitting there.
Well, the problem is that you only need 51 votes to overrule whatever John Roberts says. So if he says, look, you guys are getting a little antsy, let's take a break. It only takes 51 Republicans to say, we don't care. Let's keep going.
I think I'm in the minority here that I think this is. And I hate to say it, but it's an exercise in futility, I think. And Schiff may or may not be doing a great job. Who's going to be watching 8 hours of this a day to take it all in? I like this more than most. I'm certainly not going
to
do it.
Well, the only people that need to watch it are the senators, Steve.
Especially, well, they're talking to the American people, too. But especially when you consider that there's not new ground being broken here because of witness testimony or things like that. What they're doing is rehashing what came out of the impeachment inquiry, and just in a different, more boring form. Frankly, it's.
But what do you want?
I'd like to see witnesses cross-examined. I'd like to see, you know, Perry Mason. I'd like to, you know, and
you
make it a trial.
That may happen, right?
Yeah, and pigs may fly.
Really? You don't think so?
What?
You don't think that the Schiff and the Democrats are sort of gaining a little ground?
Mitch McConnell sat on a Supreme Court nominee for a year.
I know.
Something that had never been done in this country before. You think he's going to be pushed into putting John Bolton on the stand or Mick Mulvaney?
What do you guys think of the fact that the senators are tweeting out? The president retweeted 142 tweets and retweets yesterday. He had 142 Twitter day. Imagine that. And a lot of them were retweets of Republican senators who are calling the proceeding a scam and a sham and all of the Trump language. Well, isn't that akin to a juror standing up and going, this is crap, in the middle of the trial?
I love it.
Well, I mean...
That's awesome.
Think about that. These are the jurors.
Yeah, they don't let basketball players tweet live in the game.
Clearly not conventional jurors, and this is clearly not a conventional trial, and we maybe confuse ourselves when we use those kind of terms, because they're sitting in political judgment of this situation, and so they're not bound by... And people say that all the Republicans have made up their mind, Mitch McConnell's made up his mind. I think there are a lot of Democrats who've made up their mind as well.
Oh, for sure.
And they're all, you know, ideally you have a jury that is sequestered. You have a jury that's neutral. You wouldn't want to go to an actual criminal trial with people who've made up their minds or who could wander out of the room.
But that's why I like Steve's point. Yeah. Like bring some witnesses in. I want to see, make this something different than just everyone's made up their mind already and let's get it over.
Well, you know, Eric, you're right. The Democrats have made up their mind. It's a good exercise to keep that in mind because my thought was, well, yeah, because he did it. I mean, all the evidence shows that he did it.
I totally agree.
The only question is whether it was removable.
Perfectly persuaded that it was removable. What this is about, though, right now, I think, is campaigning to the American public. Is can you move the needle on the numbers of people who want witnesses? Can you move percentage of people who want the president removed from office? And you've seen already that it's a majority now in the polls that want him removed from office. It is
a very slim majority.
It's a slim majority. It's a significant majority that wants witnesses. And I just do not understand why the Democrats are balking on having this trade of Biden for Bolton for witnesses.
You would make that.
I would totally make that. And here's why. If Joe Biden is the nominee, what his son did, what Hunter Biden did, is going to be a huge issue through the entire campaign. It's all the Republicans can talk about. It's going to be like Benghazi again. It's like the first words out of their mouth are going to be, what about Hunter? What about Hunter? So get this out of the way. Have a national inquisition about it on live television. Have Hunter Biden in there. Have him explain his job. Have Joe Biden explain his job. Explain everything that went on there. It's not relevant to the question of the impeachment, but it's going to be aired out anyway. So let's just do that. Let's get it out of the way. And if you allow for that, then at least you put pressure on the Republicans to produce Bolton and McElveny, people like that, or Pompeo. You put the pressure on them, and you're able to bring the case forward during the Senate campaigns, the presidential campaigns, that this was a cover-up.
So
I don't see a downside.
Well, here's what I think the downside is. You will have Hunter Biden being asked about his sex life, who he's dating, what jobs he's had in the past, every damaging thing they can have. And then that will be followed by John Bolton, who will be asked very penetrating, tough questions, and he'll answer by saying, yeah, it's executive privilege. I can't. I mean, the idea that you're going to make
it
this...
It won't be a fair trade.
It's not right. going to be a fair... The idea you're going to get make this trade and get Bolton to sing,
well,
even
he
though...
he does want to testify, doesn't he?
He wants you to... He wants to testify at Barnes & Noble. He's like maybe waiting for you
his book is going to come out soon enough. I don't see the
really?
Downside.
Really? You thought
because,
that was that funny?
Yeah, I did. I think that was great. It took me a second to go, that's good.
I think the bar is pretty low for Bertrand. Whatever.
That's Bertrand.
I agree with Steve that this right now, it's the foregone conclusion of the Democrats. So I think they've got... I think it's a Hail Mary pass. But like, yeah, bring in the Bidens. Bring them all. Bring the whistleblower in. Bring
maybe,
the makeshift testify.
Maybe John Bolton or maybe John Roberts wouldn't allow it. Maybe he would say...
He doesn't get a say.
He can rule, and the Senate can overrule him one way or the other.
Oh, I see. They'd get the 51 votes.
Yeah.
Well, I just wonder if that whole scene would actually... Don't you think some of these senators might be a little chastened right now because they don't want to be seen as being that...
It's funny when it comes out of your mouth.
I get halfway into reasonable questions, and I go, what the hell am I saying?
I want to go back to, in the senators talking, the Democrats are talking too. They tend to be talking more about the need for witnesses, but they're jurors, and they're talking about it too. But you said on the air this morning about Ted Cruz, and he tweeted out that if you don't have the law on your side...
You want me to read you the quote?
Sure.
This is a quote from Ted Cruz yesterday on Twitter. If you have the facts, bang the facts. If you got the law, bang the law. If you have neither, bang the table. Today we've seen a whole lot of table banging.
And see, it's lies like that that make me so angry.
Why do you
angry.
Call those lies?
Because it's a lie. You can argue that it's not removable. You can argue that they're doing a bad job. But there are facts being presented. They are facts that were testified to under oath by members of the Trump administration. They are presenting facts there. You might not like them or think they're that bad, but you act as if, or you treat the American people like you think they're stupid when you put out tweets like that.
Well, and Ted Cruz, he's the guy who Trump called his wife ugly and said his dad helped with the JFK assassination, and he's down there shining Trump shoes now. I mean, Cruz is reprehensible, in my opinion.
Is there an argument on the right, on the Republican side, that's in support of the president that he didn't do anything wrong? Is that that where we're at, or are they just saying that the Democrats are doing this for political
purposes? So Senator Mike Brown of the great state of Indiana tweeted out a clip of him at a press conference. He was asked, did the president, if this happened, was it wrong? Is the president entitled to ask a foreign country for help in an election? And he said, I'm not even answering that question because the president didn't do that.
Didn't do what?
So that he did not ask a foreign country for help in an election, which defies logic, right? Because we all heard him do it in the quasi-transcript. And then we all saw the president do it on the lawn of the White House when he asked China to help.
And then in Ukraine again.
Right.
China should start an investigation into the Biden. Because what happened in China is just about as bad as what happened with Ukraine. So I would say that President Zelensky... If it were me, I would recommend that they start an investigation into the Bidens.
So that's where we are.
That's interesting to hear because it feels like it's just we've let one side of the debate become, well, your side is just doing it for politics and not really getting at the core issue, which is did a sitting president use the power of the office and the power of the presidency to help himself?
Well, I'm thinking of what Mick Mulvaney said when he said, get used to it. This is what we do. And he didn't mean to be damning the administration. He meant, yes, of course, this political
quid pro quo. Yeah.
Get over it.
I think what he meant was there's a political consideration in everything we do. Of course, there's political ramifications, but is that why we did it, or is even that what happened? And I think he was trying to badly argue that that's not what happened. It was the kind of argument I make sometimes that gets you in trouble, where you're trying to defer a little to the other side. Yes, of course, there's politics, but this wasn't that, I thought, was his point.
I think the Republicans are going to end up relying on Alan Dershowitz's argument, which is like basically, what he did was is not admirable, but it's not impeachable. The Dershowitz this year.
That's your newspaper's opinion, too. That's the editorial in the Tribune.
I do not speak for them.
The Tribune said censure, not impeach.
And I don't agree with them on that. I think this is a far more serious matter than they seem to think that it is. And I think that this, if this is not impeachable, then what is? What kind of abuse of office could you countenance? I mean, and if someone said, could he sell Alaska to Putin for $25? I mean, what could he do that would cross the line.
Well, I would say spend 20% of his time at properties that make him money.
I've thought about some of the things people are agitated about that may or may not be impeachable. They're not even talking about that. If it's emoluments, that might be impeachable. And
that's
one in five days,
two.
He's at one
that's
of his properties.
That's season two of the impeachment.
The District of Columbia, of Columbia filed suit yesterday against the inauguration
right.
committee and a couple of companies that own the Trump Hotel.
Since we spending money that
benefited the Trumps.
And since we last convened, was the Office of Management and Budget said that he broke the law
right.
by not turning that money over to Ukraine. He broke the law. That was a violation of law. Not a criminal law, but it's a violation of law. And they're like shrugging it off like, no, that's no big deal.
All right, let's move on to something else. This topic will be here tomorrow. Probably, what, Clinton's went 7 weeks.
My little pocket forecast is that the Republicans are going to do their argument in like a day, and then they're going to move to adjourn. They say, look, we don't want to hear witnesses. They'll vote against witnesses, maybe 51 to 49 vote against witnesses, and then they'll acquit them 53-47. Is that what it is?
Yeah.
I'm going to read from a New York Times op-ed by David Jackson and Gary Marks. You work with these guys?
I do.
Are they Are they based out of Chicago?
They're based out of Chicago. In fact, they're often work in a room just across the room from me. So
here's a couple of Chicago Tribune journalists with an op-ed in the New York Times, and it says, "We are investigative reporters in a great American city infamous for its corruption and murders." And then they go on to talk about how the hedge fund Alden Global Capital in November acquired 32% of Tribune Publishing Company shares, becoming the largest shareholder, and it is angling for control of the company. The company owns the Chicago Tribune newspaper. They list them, the Daily News of New York, the Baltimore Sun, Hartford Current, etc. They say they're worried that what's going to happen to the Tribune is what happened when they, quote, decimated the Denver Post. The Chicago Tribune, they write, was founded in 1847. Ever since, it has played an outsized role in the national conversation. They remind you that Abraham Lincoln was a subscriber, 27 Pulitzers by the Tribune alone. They remind us also that 2,100 papers have vanished across the country since 2004. And then they write this. The Tribune does not just safeguard the city. By devoting coverage to every aspect of daily life, it creates a sense of community. Facebook and other social media sites give the impression that they offer everything you need to know, but in reality, most of Facebook's news is generated in traditional newsrooms. If we disappear, its news feed will consist of little more than news releases and opinion-based screeds. Unless Alden reverses course, we need a civic-minded local owner or group of owners, so do our Tribune publishing colleagues. They're looking for a billionaire.
Well, let me first.
What about Michael Farrow? He's a rising billionaire.
Let me first speak in defense of opinion-based screeds. it was a great piece that they wrote, very important piece that we wrote, and we're worried around the newsroom. We're quite worried about this because on June 30th. A certain cap comes off of Alden's activity, and they are then going to be able to buy more than the third of the company they now have.
Why do people buy newspapers that don't want to run newspapers? I don't understand that.
Well, there's money to be made if you buy them up and you decimate them, as they say that they did to the Denver Post, which I think is a fair characterization of what happened there. And then you get in and get out. We had problems with Sam Zell, the real estate magnate, who bought us about, what was it, 10, 11 years ago, and we were all quite worried about that. Sam Zell, though, had pretensions of being the guy who could save American journalism. He thought he knew how to reinvent newspapers and make them profitable and great again. I don't have that sense from Alden Global Capital. I think they're money people, and they want to make money. And what they'll do is they'll come in and they'll slash the staff, and they'll cut it as far down as they can whilst they can still maintain the subscriber base. They'll try to weigh that out in a way. And then if it starts to go sideways, they'll sell off and they'll walk away with a lot of money, like Michael Farrow did.
Yeah.
The guy who
the last billionaire. The curious thing about the argument is there is no argument. That's the weirdest thing about this story, is that you'll hear, whether it's that opinion piece or other pieces that have been about this transaction, you're waiting for the other side to go, we're not going to do that. There never is. There never is. It's almost like, in a way, they're like, yeah, that's what we do.
Yeah, you haven't heard anyone from Alden coming on saying,
no
one, you know,
there's
on.
No, like, no, we're civic-minded. We're going to build
David,
up. There's
calm
no,
down.
At least lie to us.
They're
come
not
on,
even
make
lying.
Feel good
they're just
for
like,
day.
Yeah, that's what we do. So that's
so,
the scary
So the wolf
part.
Isn't even wearing grandma's clothes.
Yeah, they're just,
now I'm a wolf. I'm going to eat you.
Yeah, there it's coming in. We'll just wait for July.
So what's it like in the newsroom when this goes out? Because I saw them interviewed. And they presented it, I think, to the editors the day before.
Yes, they said that they presented it to the editors the day before.
The editors really said, please don't do this.
Don't do this, yeah. I don't know what the damage
Talk about the courage of their convictions. Yeah. I mean, I suppose somebody at Alden read this, too.
Yeah, I mean, these guys are first class, both of them there, and they're very decorated investigative journalists, and they have a lot of clout.
So what is it like in the newsroom?
What's it like? Well, one of the things that's going on right now is that buyouts are on the table. They're trying to pay people off to leave, basically, to try to get you to retire.
After only 8 years, which is a very low threshold.
After 8 years, yeah. 8 years is the minimum, I think, and then after that, I don't remember all the exact details of it, but essentially they're trying to get people to retire, and then they pay them a portion of their salary to go out the door. And those windows are going to be closing in the next week or two, and we'll know who's actually leaving. And then after that, I think my guess is that there's going to be some sort of a threshold they're going to have to meet for cutting the budget, and then I don't know where that goes and how they're going to do that. But all of us around the newsroom are worried that this is a very risky, fraught time.
Do you wonder if the readers and the subscribers and also just the people who rely on news in Chicago have heard this ringing of the bell before? Meaning every time that the newspaper is in trouble, whether it's the Chicago Tribune or the Sun-Times or the Health of another site, it seems like the death knell, the doom bell, the midnight, we get closer to midnight on news. And maybe they're not reacting, or there doesn't seem to be some seriousness about it, because every single time a newspaper gets bought or sold or anything, this kind of conversation comes up.
We still have the Sun-Times.
I know Justin's going to be co-moderating the Journalism Town Hall, the 10th anniversary of the first Journalism Town Hall coming up in, was it?
February 23rd.
Yeah. And all those issues are going to be on the table. I was part of the first one, and we had this exact conversation. We're like, oh my God, the Tribune and Sun-Times are dying. The internet's going to eat our lunch. 10 years later, we're still around, but we're still very threatened. And you're right. Are we crying wolf too much? I don't think people in Denver would say that we were.
I would buy you guys and put my name on it. It'd be the John Williams Chicago Tribune. I wouldn't even do that. But I mean, is it unthinkable?
Pizza toppings on the front page.
You have said before that the same way we support operas and symphonies and museums, we should support journalism. It's a shame it's come to that. To me, that's not even such a sad idea. I think that's If I was the Ricketts or the Griffins or Oprah.
Greenhouse, I worked for a news organization that was owned by Joe Ricketts, mm-hmm. and it was not puppy dogs and unicorns and rainbows. You know, he shut us down because we tried to unionize. And
but he also, okay, go ahead.
Right. Joe Ricketts, not Tom Ricketts.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, when he sort of fired us all, he said that he misunderstood how difficult it would be to make money at a news organization. He thought that would be the easy part. He thought the hard part would be to create an editorially sound project, because whenever we had meetings with him, he would talk about how committed he was to having, you know, fair and objective journalism. And he thought that was going to be much tougher than it actually was, because he hired a whole bunch of good journalists, not to, you know, pat myself on the back. But the fact that for, you know, 4 or 5 years, that's the sort of the operating assumptions that he was operating under made all of us in that room, you know, people were crying, people, you know, were just really upset. It made me, you know, sort of suck in my breath and say, well, that's just appalling.
That you would doubt our commitment to
that
being
neutral. You had such a misunderstanding of the economics of the news industry, that you thought that it was going to be easy to sell display ads to mom and pop businesses in Chicago neighborhoods, because that was the business model for a while.
This was DNA Info.
This was DNA Info. And, you know, so I read that op-ed and I cringed a little. And I cringed a little for two reasons. One, after my experience, I cannot believe that another billionaire is the answer. I just cannot, because I lived through that. And it was a horrendous experience. And two, part of the op-ed seemed to say that, like, there were things that the Tribune could do that no other kind of news organization could do. And that's 100% true. However, there was an element of all of these online news organizations that are popping up can't pick up the slack. And on one level, yes, that's true. But I wish that that op-ed had made the case for the Tribune without denigrating other kinds of media. And yes, I'm tooting my own horn here because I'm, you know, sort of at the forefront of online journalism. But we are not very good as a business of building each other up.
Especially yet. When backs are against the wall.
Yeah, and I've heard that complaint from others, people in another online organization.
Really?
And this town does have some very fun, not just Heather's, but ProPublica, the BGA, that are doing great work. They tend to partner with print organizations or with WBEZ or other news outlets to amplify their great work. They did give it a little bit of a short shrift to that. I think maybe they didn't pay quite enough attention to how that was going to land. You know, these organizations can't do it alone. I think that was more their point, is like you need these large, robust organizations to provide the kind of atmosphere where you can allow the services that these organizations do that are filling in really important gaps that are not there.
See how that would sting you, but you know, I'm somewhat close to you all in the business, and I didn't even think of that. I didn't read that. I just thought, as I say at the end of my show sometimes, or in the middle of my show sometimes, if you don't already, today would be a good day to subscribe to a newspaper. And then I thought I should amend that with, or patronize the sponsors of talk shows, because that's how we make our money. But the point is, let's all, with some sort of dollars, support the work that these people do.
We're a subscription model, and I cannot tell you the number of times that I tweet a link to a story and somebody's in my mentions saying, it's behind a paywall. How am I supposed to read it? And every day I stop myself from tweeting back, you know, how about you drop us a cost of a cup of coffee and subscribe? The fundamental problem was that back in the, you know, mid-90s, yep, we all decided that news was free. And so there's a whole generation of people out there who believe that news should be free, and are angry that we are now asking them to pay for the services which we provide. And it just drives me nuts. And that's the fundamental problem. And that can't be solved by another billionaire coming in and purchasing a news organization and having the final say over what goes in the newspaper and what stays out of the newspaper.
Let me push back a little on that. I mean, I think we're looking for our Jeff Bezos, essentially.
So I know that Jeff Bezos has done really great things at the Washington Post. I hear from people all the time who are more on the conservative side of things, who have heard that message from the president that it is owned by Bezos and that Bezos has an axe to grind, and that that makes all of that coverage suspect. And I can't disagree with them. That's what we're taught to do as journalists.
Why can't you disagree with them? You can disagree.
I think they're wrong, but I understand where they're coming from.
Why? Because
if Bezos says, you know what, I don't want to be in this anymore, or if you're making my life harder at Amazon, he can pull the plug like that.
That makes you vulnerable, but it doesn't make you wrong. I mean,
no,
the journalism,
it does create an appearance of a conflict of interest, and it's one that the president has used repeatedly to ding the Washington Post.
I feel like, as present company excluded, and Mr. Zorn and all the fine people that work at the Tribune, that the argument that the city would suffer if the Chicago Tribune went under is short-sighted, in the way that I believe that there are great journalists in town telling the stories that need to be told. How they get to viewers, to listeners, to whatever, is still not figured out by the Tribune. A civic, that's what Heather's saying, a civic-minded billionaire coming in is not going to fix why Facebook and Google are making all the money that the Tribune should. They're not going to fix how the fact that we all are not paying attention, that people that are 10, 15 years younger than us don't read the newspaper. They don't read, that they don't go to your page.
Well, no, they don't go to our page, but they read our content. They don't subscribe to our...
They don't pay for it.
They're not home delivery subscribers. They're not, I mean, and you're right about that. I mean, the idea behind a billionaire is someone coming in, maybe who a benign owner who would buy it. And
that's what I was thinking.
Civic reference, and maybe someone who is not so politically, or I mean, my fear is like Ken Griffin will buy it.
Well, I mean, wasn't that what the model used to be? That, I mean, Mrs. Pinchon, and I mean, you know, that the families, before the Tribune went public, that the families did own the newspapers in town, and they were sort of benign dictators.
I'll speak up in defense of the Tribune. It's a profitable organization. It's making money. It's just not making enough money to be owned by a hedge fund.
I want to go back to, would the community suffer? And I think it absolutely would suffer. And Eric, we had this conversation a couple years ago. I don't know if you remember, but it's already suffered. The benefit is we've got great voices. We've got, you know, Heather's site, and we had DNA Info. We had all of those things. And maybe this is me sounding old, but back in the day when you had dominant newspapers, we had a stronger sense of community. Right or wrong, the newspapers sort of set the news agenda.
I don't know, man. I don't buy that.
Okay, that's fine. You don't have to, but I'm telling you that there was sort of a... And this is back when there were four channels. We had fewer things to watch, so we had more things in common.
Yeah,
and
but that's not true. There were.
I'm going to punch you in the face.
There were communities. There were communities, Steve, on the that never got into the Tribune,
and they were excluded. Okay, you're right.
And it caused a lot of the problems we have today: segregation, discrimination, all that kind of stuff, or just not feeling like people were prisoners. So now we're in a position where those people can be heard. I think the bigger issue for me is
are they being heard? If we're so diffuse now that there is no one voice or 10 voices, are they?
I don't know.
They've got an outlet, but are they getting an audience?
That's the question. The question at the end of the day is, I think that the civic-minded billionaires of the world shouldn't be necessarily knee-jerking into buying the Chicago Tribune. I think they should be thinking about, where are the distribution models and what can we do to make sure there's audience for these people? Where can we build the new newspaper? And that's the problem I don't see enough people getting involved in. Instead, what you have are hedge funds going, how can I make as much money?
Yeah, but is the new newspaper a big, colossal Chicago Tribune?
I think about Google. Google is somehow absent in this conversation. They have completely gutted local journalism. Google has found a way to make all the money off everybody, because Google and Facebook have found a way for you to read the newspaper without actually having to buy the newspaper. Number two, I think it's possible that we could have an ecosystem where maybe, even since Google is over on Fulton, work with them in some way that say Google News is Google Chicago, something like that, Facebook Chicago, where all the stuff comes into one feed, and you're not necessarily loyal to the brand. You're more interested in the stories that are presented.
Do you guys think that the Tribune's footprint in this community, though, would be akin to, if we lost it in a way that you would recognize it, like losing the Cubs or the Bears? Or I'm trying to think of things that really matter to people, the social fabric of our town.
I don't know that it would be that kind of a moment where people would notice it right away, but I think that in the long run, that you rely on these larger news organizations, and we're not the only one. I mean, there are other large news organizations that are at the meetings, that Heather's at all the time. They're at the county board meeting, at the city council meeting. They're out in the suburbs. They're at these meetings. They are on the ground covering the news, and when those go away, you don't really notice it so much, but in some ways, the void, I mean, in that darkness is where corruption grows.
That is so true. I mean, so some of the other stories I wanted to talk about are the sorts of things we know about because people like the two of you, particularly, we're talk show hosts. You guys are a journalist and you're a columnist.
You said that dripping with disdain, Justin.
I was meant to drip with, disdain for myself?
Yes.
Not for you. Absolutely.
Not for me. Yes.
I mean, really, think about it. The things that we know about and talk about, the way our city gets held in check for its corruption is because the newspapers and sites keep reporting on it. The red light camera thing. So we had a legislator on this week. He said, okay, we need to make red light cameras illegal. They all need to be shut down in Illinois. That bill may pass, right? But I guarantee you we would not have known about that. That wouldn't be happening were it not for journalists doing that work.
Amen. I think what they're talking about is someone to save someone or something, some group of investors to stave off this day when Alden Global Capital comes in and buys more than 50% of the 50% of the Tribune and then decides that it's going to cut the staff in half.
Mm. I mean, that's essentially what happened at the Sun-Times. You know, the Sun-Times was poised to get swallowed up by the Tribune, and a group of investors backed by labor unions got together and sort of said, no, we're going to put up the money to keep it independent. And that's where we are right now with the Sun-Times. And the Sun-Times is doing fantastic work. You know, but does the Sun-Times have to deal with questions about its objectivity when they report on issues involving labor unions who pay their salaries and who are keeping it afloat? I think they do. I think that if you have a business model that works, where you're beholden only to the people who pay for your content, it's an easier argument when people say, when people question your motives or question why you're doing something.
The media outlets, the newspapers, never were reliant only on the people for whom they were writing.
But the ads, most newspapers.
I mean, there used to be owners. There were previous owners to newspapers who were in it to make money too.
Sure, and I think that's fine, but it's got to be transparent. But if your ultimate fate relies on Jeff Bezos still wanting to be in the newspaper industry, if I worked for the Washington Post, that would make it hard for me to sleep at night, because I have seen what happens when it goes wrong, and it is devastating. And the neighborhoods of Chicago, and all due respect to the Tribune, sometimes were not being covered in the way that DNA Info covered them.
Totally
and
right.
And Black Club Chicago is certainly doing its best to create a new model.
But they shouldn't have had to either. I mean, if I lived in Joliet and something was going on in Barrington or Tinley Park, then I don't know that I would have read those stories.
Sure. So the problem is that for so long, and again, all due respect to the Tribune, which I grew up reading, for so many years, and this is to Justin's point, they prioritized what happened in Barrington and Wilmette and Winnetka over what happened on the South Side and the West Side.
Well, they set the news agenda, right?
Right.
And the news agenda was usually white dudes.
It's a tough balancing act.
See, Bertrand's leaving. He's going to do the news. Justin Kaufman's got an interview. He's taping for his radio show. So now it's
Heather and I got nothing better to do.
Eric, Heather, I spent some twice this week. I interviewed Teo Hardeman. Should I have? He's this, I don't know what he is. He's an interesting character, right?
He's a gadfly.
That's
the word I would use.
I had a word for him, like community activist or something. He's run for office. He's in charge of an anti-violence organization right now. But anyway, his idea is that we've got these storefronts that are selling marijuana, and that they prioritize the medicinal shops, and now you've got some retail points. But that's a lot of money, and those are established players. He said the young black men in the neighborhoods know all about selling pot. Literally, he's saying this, and that they ought to be able to sell weed out of trucks, like a food vendor, or at farmers markets, and the costs will be lower, and he wants the cost for licensure to be about $250, not $250,000.
I'm picturing a truck like driving down the street playing Grateful Dead songs like the
ice cream truck. Only it's now little kids running after the pot man. The pot man's here. Mom, quick, give me $100. The pot man's here. And I'm intrigued by that notion. I see the logic of it. I also see how preposterous it is.
I think that there are all kinds of practical hurdles to it, but I don't. I mean, if we're going to be normalizing and regulating marijuana in a sort of a normal way, I don't see an actual. I don't have a principled problem with it. That right now we're in this interesting stage of development where we're trying to figure out how we're going to sell it, where people are going to be allowed to smoke it, and so on. But the idea, I mean, I'm not exactly sure about trucks going down the street, but I think it should be and will end up being regulated and sold, kind of like we regulate and sell liquor.
Mom and pop shops on every corner.
You don't have liquor trucks going down the street.
No,
but
you don't.
But you do have a lot of corner bars, and I think that's where we're going to head. And I think Hardeman is making, to the extent that he's making a broader point, that this community has been shut out of this retail opportunity right now, is being shut out right now, is a good one.
Yeah,
I think that's what he's really saying. I don't think it's workable, and I'm not sure that I love the idea of the trucks.
I can understand why they feel like they're being left out.
Sure. It's this constant source of conflict at City Hall right now, where aldermen want to do X, Y, or Z, such as allowing cannabis cafes to open. Like, you could go in and you could buy an edible and consume it on the site right now. That's prohibited under state law.
Springfield will have a smoking lounge. Springfield is contemplating.
Right.
That.
So there are provisions in the law to do that, but they aren't sort of in place yet. And the city is really divided on where these shops should go, and they're not divided along the lines that you might think. There are lots of African-American aldermen who are worried that this is going to make the attempts to keep kids away from drugs and to, you know, prevent this from sort of hurting their communities more, it's going to make it more difficult.
Yeah, I totally understand that. That's been my soapbox on this for a long time. No, I was for legalizing marijuana right after the time we did it, and then I went, oh no.
Oh, this might be a bad idea.
That's kind of where I am.
Which is why the law is so strict, which is why, you know, the city has very designated areas. You You have to go through all sorts of hoops to open up a recreational cannabis dispensary. And I was telling somebody this the other day, there are no purely recreational cannabis dispensaries in the city of Chicago right now. And there likely won't be for at least another month or so.
Oh, really? Every retail point is a medicinal one?
Every single one. And two companies have asked the city for permission to open up recreational cannabis dispensaries. And they have both not made it all the way through
the process. Well, if you care about the fairness of that, from a retail point, those other guys are establishing a huge footprint, aren't
Absolutely.
They? I get flyers in the mail from them all the time from my neighborhood store. I mean, you know, like Target flyers. I get mailers from them saying, come on over and pick up what you need. If branding means anything, those guys sure have a head start.
Like I said, I think it's going to happen. It's going to take a while. It's going to maybe take a decade or more for it to be sort of become such part of life that we're not talking about it all the time, and it's sold the way liquor is sold, and that it just isn't as big an issue.
But. Do you guys like the idea of banning all red light cameras? They should all come down?
So I think there are two arguments. One is this program itself corrupt? I think there's probably evidence that there have been corrupt actions involving it.
I'll go first, yes.
The second question is do red light cameras reduce crashes and injuries? And there is evidence to suggest that they do. Now, we're not talking about the red light cameras who pop people for $100 a time if you don't make a complete stop before turning right on red. That, I think, most people agree is where sort of like the cash grab aspect of it.
So, I just paid $100 to the city for not coming to a full stop on a right turn on red, and It irritated me because I even watched the video, and it's like it wasn't unsafe. It wasn't like, oh, I almost hit that guy. I was busted. I paid it. But I agree with that. I think that they should limit them to people who run red lights, who go through a red light, and I think that they need to lengthen the time of the yellow light to sort of because they're very short. Because I do think there are people who just ignore those limits, and I think, you know, the speed cameras and red light cameras, if they're catching people who are seriously violating traffic laws, which people do, I'm all for them. So I don't think they should. I think they should be like, what's the expression? Mend it, don't end it. In terms of this program,
we had Austin Berg on, who couldn't join us today for the podcast. He's frequently here, but at the Illinois Policy Institute, they've done a lot of writing on this, and he said on our show last week that the amount of money raised by those cameras in 10 years. Is $1 billion. Can you, I mean, now you see why they don't want to give them up. $1 billion. Maybe we should do it, Eric, like we'll watch the camera footage, and if your car's just rolling through, it was safe, and you essentially came to a stop, but you didn't come to a stop, $5. But if you zoom through at 50, then that's $100, and I'll be the judge of how much the fine should be. It'll be subjective. What do you think of that?
I wouldn't mind some instant replay review that was more subjective. On the other hand, that adds such a layer of bureaucracy that it just, in some ways, what they're doing now is easier. I would just say that the right turn on red, it would have to be really flagrant and dangerous. And you could look and say, like, look, you almost hit somebody or you almost hit a pedestrian, but that's probably not going to happen. I do think that they should be aimed at safety. I don't mind that they're also aimed at revenue. If there was such a thing as stop sign cameras, you could put one in my neighborhood and people roll through the stop sign in my neighborhood.
But that's a Chicago stop. It's our city-given right.
This is where I'd say, yeah, that was actually good enough. No fine at all.
If they fined those people $25, everyone who rolls through there, $25, that we would have no city budget crisis.
Yeah, but that's it. That's the thing that bothers me about this. It's not about safety. It's never really about safety. Or it's only about safety because it's about money, right? I mean, that's why marijuana is legal, too. That's why we're going to go into the gambling business.
I mean, I would love to have the time and the resources to do a study of how many tickets are still being issued by Rahm Emanuel speed cams near parks and schools, because that was a huge thing.
Oh, yeah. Put those I got in. One of those.
And you don't hear that about it anymore.
It made sense until you went, wait, 60% of the city or some ginormous percentage of the city is near a park or a school. So essentially, it's kind of this hard to define.
I would love to know whether drivers' behaviors in those areas have significantly changed. Future.
I still think, well, maybe because I got a ticket once, but I sure think about it when I'm near a school. I got to make sure I look at my speedometer.
Well, and the thing is, like, the parks can be closed and you can still get caught.
Right. It could be a Saturday.
I drive home from the Old Town School every week when I have this evening event there, and I drive home late at night and the park's closed, and I always slow way down because I know that they're going to get you if you go over 30 miles an hour. And it's crazy because the park is closed. There's not going to be kids in the park.
Last piece of advice for me, John Williams, is shovel your damn sidewalks.
Yes.
Shovel your damn sidewalks, okay? The city's going to start finding people. Some of the aldermen are starting to nick people more, and I'm all for that. Shovel your sidewalks. By the way, Eric, a friend of mine came in from out of town from Minneapolis. We went to the Old Town School of Folk Music a couple nights ago. It was really cold and snowy, and there were some Hawaiian singers there. They were fantastic. And just to plug, because I know you do a lot with the Old Town School, or you're there a lot,
I'm there a lot. I mean, we just do the annual program up there, but I don't. Otherwise, I'm just up there playing music with people.
I thought, what am I going to the Old Town School for Hawaiian music? But I realized anytime I go there, whatever I hear is always so good that it almost doesn't matter the genre.
One thing that's very interesting to me about the Old Town School is it's not like, oh, there's an Old Town School here, and there's one in Milwaukee and St. Louis and Indianapolis and, you know, Atlanta. It is really a unique institution, and it's really a treasure. And you walk around there like on a Saturday afternoon, you see all these people with their guitars on their backs, yeah. And you think, what a great place to be.
I forget exactly how he put it, but the guy that introduced the band from the Old Town School reminded everybody this is the largest such institution of its kind in the country. And I don't know exactly what it was that he was describing. Is it a teaching place or a performing place or some combination?
It's the fact that it does all that stuff.
There's no bigger one in the country.
And a community outreach place, too. It's a civic treasure, really. Where we did our live podcast, the first and only time we had did that.
Oh, yeah. By the way, I meant to mention this at the beginning. We're wrapping it up now, but we did get some response from people saying, hey, bring the Mincing Rascals to my community, my bar, my place. I'm still just nervous about nobody showing up. I'm insecure. So email johnwilliams@wgnradio.com and promise me you'll show up if we do this. Okay, Eric Zorn, thanks for coming in.
Great to see you.
Steve Bertrand, thanks for coming in. He's gone. Justin left, so maybe we've gone long. Heather, it's always a pleasure to have you here.
Happy to be here.
We're produced by Elif Garris. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another pod on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.